Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
You know, a couple of years beforehand, I was smoking opium up in the Himalayas, and in my head, I wanted to get back and then write that story of going from there to winning an All-Ireland.
Welcome all, it is episode 64 of Behind the Lines, here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. This week's guest is John Leonard, author of the award-winning 2015 book Dub Sub Confidential, which has been heralded as one of the best GAA books ever written. It documents John's stint as second-choice goalkeeper for Dublin behind Stephen Cluxton, but it also explores much beyond that. It delves into his extraordinary life. In the book, John details his abuse at the hands of Father Ivan Payne as a child and the heavy drinking and the drug-taking it led to later in his life. John has lived a fairly remarkable life thus far, so we're absolutely delighted that he's joining us on the show. So let's listen into our conversation with John Leonard. John, what's the crack? Thanks very much for doing the show.
Thank you for having me, Gavin. Good to be here.
So the whole country pretty much knew you fairly well by the end of 2015 after the book came out. So what have you been up to since?
I spent a couple of years back in Ireland from sort of 2015, 2016, promoting the book, doing all the tours and doing all the stuff that went with it. And then myself and my wife left Ireland, went to Vietnam. We went to Vietnam for a year and a half and spent a bit of time on the coast there, a place called Hoi An and in Da Nang. And then while we were there, my wife got pregnant and we came back to New Zealand then, where my wife is from, to have our little boy, Phoenix, who's now two. So we've been here in New Zealand since then. Kind of lucky timing-wise that we came back here when we did. We got back here and our business was going well. And then we got, obviously last year, everyone got hit with COVID, hit with all the lockdowns. And we were quite blessed where we were at the time with the business, the way it was, to be looked after here quite well in New Zealand. Mm. So that's what's happened in the last few years. Right now, we're up in the north part of New Zealand, a couple of hours north, and it's good, you know, very, very rural, quite subtropical climates, and good people, and a good place to be, especially when you have kids, you know, very good place for raising little nippers.
Yeah, has he had an O'Neill's football in his arms yet?
He's had a hurl, there's a few Gaelic clubs and groups and that. So he's a good man with a hurl and a schlitter. But they have no sign of the O'Neills. But we give him plenty of time. There's an abundance of footballs around the house, I have to say.
The bad news for Phoenix is that by the time he's finished playing minor, Stephen Cluxton might still be in goals for Dublin.
Yeah. I don't think Cluck has any children yet. So, he could still be going. You never know. He could be a robot or some kind of cyborg, you know. Who knows?
What's the business, by the way?
We do websites. Build websites. We're like a boutique digital media agency. So we do all copywriting, SEO. Myself and my wife are both obviously writers, but my wife as well. So we help people with their copy and help people build their websites, design websites, that kind of stuff. It's good. It's a flexible kind of thing. We've been doing it for sort of 8-9 years. It all kind of started with the blogging, which is where a lot of the stuff for me started. With Sober Paddy doing the blogging, doing the writing. My wife was doing it as well. So we just got very used to using websites for the last 10 years or so. So we're just sharing all that. We're building a few courses and that this year and share all that information with people. Mm-hmm. So they too can have wonderful website world plans.
So like, how did you find the reception of the book? Because it was like, it was pretty much a sensation in Ireland, like.
Yeah, it was amazing, really. You know, I went to a Temple of Sound reunion, which was like a place where we used to go clubbing back in the day. And there was a reunion on their 25th anniversary when I was back in Dublin, and we went to that. And I was in the queue going up to get a drink or whatever it was, and a lad beside me, just, you know, old school looking clubber, and he just turned around and goes, How are you, man? Yeah, love the book there. Brilliant read, you know. I didn't know him from Adam, and I just thought that was amazing, you know, to somebody probably not in the, maybe he wasn't in the GAA circle, but he kind of recognised the story, recognised it. He liked it from the perspective of what it brought to that kind of scene, as well as just being a, well, the guy and the rest of it story. So it was so well received. I was amazed. I was amazed at how well it did. You know, I'm very, very happy that it was so well received, because, you know, when you write something yourself, when you put your heart and soul into it, you do want it to be, I suppose, respected and enjoyed, you know, and when it is, it's extremely satisfying. You know?
Yeah, so, like, how do you reflect on the book now when you see it up on a shelf? Is it pure pride?
It's pure nothing. I mean, I'm still kind of, when I see the book, I mean, instantly I look at the picture of the original, the first edition was me and Cluxton, and we were separated. It was an old photo that got cut in the middle and brought together. We weren't actually beside each other in the frame, and they put it in the middle and put him as this, the king, and I was this jester. And I just sort of cringe still when I see that. You know, originally I had no idea that that would be part of the... I just sent them all these photos, which I thought might be in the middle of the book, you know, when you see these kings when he was a kid and when he did this. But then he said they decided to use that book. So when I see the book, I cringe, to be honest, when I see that version of it. Because it wasn't when they sent me that original front cover, I went, oh, this is some kind of joke, isn't it? I mean, I can't have this. But the publishers had different minds about it, and they were pretty strong, and I didn't really have much say, to be honest, which at that stage I'd sort of given them control over that part of the project. So I asked to make some changes, and I got a few, but it wasn't what I wanted. But there you go. So I kind of cringe when I see that. But in general, like when I read reviews and when I hear people's feedback and that kind of thing, I do like, you know, it's good. I'm happy, you know. I haven't read the book, to be honest. I haven't really gone back and looked at it more than reading a few pages here and there, because I don't know, it's just kind of you read it, you write it, and then you kind of you leave it, you know, you leave, put so much into it. So I suppose I haven't really much more than that kind of thing. Cringe, pride at the reviews, and that's probably it.
Yeah, you should read it. It's pretty good. You put your heart and soul into it. But I was interested to see the Irish Times did this interview a couple of weeks ago, and you said that you didn't actually find the process of writing it that cathartic. Is that right?
Yeah. Not at all. Like, there was nothing really in it that was, be honest, like, the original reason we were in New Zealand, we'd been traveling for a few years in Latin America, and came back. My wife had written a couple of books at this stage, and we were low on funds, and she said, John, it's your turn. One day, she said, it's your turn to write the book, because we knew we'd get an advance, whatever. A few grand or 5 or 6 grand, whatever it would be at the time. So I had to put a few ideas together, and then that started the whole journey of it. And then the writing process of it was pure, initially mechanical, like trying to get the story right, trying to get the timeline right, trying to get the structure right, then remembering all the details. And so there was nothing, I was never staring out and just wistfully remembering these old things. It was kind of, that happened there, that happened then, that happened, okay. And then the flow kind of came from it. So there was no real, there was no moments where I felt lightened by, you know, going over my past. And weirdly, or not weirdly, but the only reason, the whole thing about being abused, and that never really was in my mind to write when I initially sent the ideas in Penguin. And I was never going to write about that. But when I started delving into all my alcoholism and all my drugs and all my and the madness I was part of for most of my life, or for a good chunk of it, I realized that there was something underneath it all, and I started to drill back into my own self. So whether it wasn't really cathartic, but it certainly was eye-opening for me to kind of realize a lot about myself. But that was merely trying to get the structure of my chapters correct for Penguin. That was kind of giving me this... insight into my own personality. So never really cathartic, but certainly, you know, I suppose eye-opening in certain respects for myself, you know.
Yeah. Like, I guess you discover things about yourself that you didn't fully know then. And like, did you draw a lot of them? Did everything really draw back to the abuse?
I mean, it did and it didn't, you know. I mean, I suppose when you think about it, it's hard to know what your life would be like if you weren't abused or something super dramatic like that didn't happen to you when you're young. And that's, it's an unquantifiable kind of thing. You can't sort of say, well, I know for sure I would have made it as a professional footballer, or, you know, I would have been far more, you don't know. Life is, you can't sort of revisit the past like that. But certainly a lot of my madness and a lot of my sheer fuckedness of it all was linked heavily to those few years when in my late teens and all that stuff was going on with Ivor Payne. I mean, a lot of teenagers rebel and that, but I hadn't really until all that sort of stuff started coming out, or at least not heavily, you know. So, yeah, I think a lot of it did have to do with Father Ivor Payne and the abuse, you know. And certainly going off the rails in my early 20s and that, yeah, and mid-20s, definitely all linked to it, you know.
Mm. What kind of influences did you lean on, writing influences, when you were writing the book?
I suppose I never really thought about them too much, but I suppose maybe looking back at what I was reading and what I enjoyed reading, would have been those kind of books like Paul Kimmage's has written a couple of great ones. Like, I remember reading Rough Ride when I was in my teenage years, and I thought that was absorbing. It was like I don't know if it was a blog style, but it was certainly, if I remember correctly, I think it was written from the first person. And he really brought you inside that kind of world of what was going on behind the scenes in this Tour de France experience that he had. And I found that really absorbing. And all those other kind of sports books, like I've read a lot of them. Like, I remember reading Robbie Fowler's biography and Steven Gerrard's. These big name stories are just so bland and so uninteresting. And they never really got to you, never really captured what it was like to be in there and be around it. So when I was writing it, that's what I wanted to really bring. I wanted to, like, for me, being in the Dublin dressing room eventually when I got there in my late 20s, you know, was the most magical and important thing in my life, you know, to have been, like, my earliest photos, I'm wearing a Dublin jersey, to have gone to the matches in the 80s and early 90s in Croke Park and Parnell Park, and to be idolising John O'Leary and the likes, you know, throughout my life, and then to get into the dressing room having been so fucked up for years and been, you know, on all kinds of drugs all over the world and drinking heavily, and that, to eventually get in there and to sample that atmosphere, the seriousness of it, the intensity of the characters, the people who are there, you know, the talent, and to be able to then maybe articulate some of that with a funny twist, you know, from my perspective, because, you know, I idolise a lot of other writers like William Burroughs and Bukowski and all these crazy fuckers who had gone from alcoholism through to drug addiction in order to experience every part of life. So I'd done part of that as well, and I really wanted to try and get that twist into it, and without, you know, making it, you know, you've got to be very sensitive in certain respects, especially when you're dealing with a sort of close-knit circle like the group that the Dublin team were. And so I wanted to try and tell as much as I could without getting anyone in trouble and without being liable, but also letting everyone who's there enjoy it. And so that was, you know, I tried to touch on those sort of people. I think when Vincent Brown wrote Paul McGrath's book, Back from the Brink, and I really enjoyed his style of bringing that kind of the sub-story of Paul McGrath to the fore. You know, that was so compelling for me, and I wanted to sort of bring that element, even though I wasn't a superstar, and even though people wouldn't have known my name at all, they would have just said, who's another sub-keeper who's there for a couple of years. But I had an eye for what was going on, and I wanted to be able to bring those kind of elements of those sports books, you know, to a story which also had some more of the madness of these other people. And, you know, Hunter S. Thompson, that kind of Gonzo style that he always had, where he went, that Gonzo means you kind of go first person into it, so you're telling from your experience, and therefore, as people read it, they get to experience the other story, which is the bigger story that you're telling. So trying to, and I wasn't being, you know, I wasn't conscientiously thinking about all this. These were all kind of little, it's me talking to you now and thinking back. That's probably what were all the sort of filters of what was allowing me to write about certain things in certain ways.
And is it difficult, that level of honesty, is that difficult to write with?
Yeah. I mean, I've been doing it for years with Sober Paddy on the blog, and that was initially really difficult. And when you're bearing everything, you can be, you know, if you stand outside naked, you know, you've got pimples on your ass or whatever, you know, you don't necessarily look great. And when you do bear all, there's going to be stuff that other people, that's why I changed all my mates' names and my friends' names. I didn't want them to be feeling uncomfortable because of me exposing myself in many respects. So it was difficult, but I suppose the biggest challenge for me was overcoming that idea of talking about the abuse, you know, because a lot of people, at least in my head, I had a stigma about it being abused. And I know people, many other people have been abused who will never talk about it. I know the story, but they won't share it because there's a stigma and whether you want to move on or whatever it is. So for me to put it out there, it meant that it was going to be a story like 5 years on from a book about an incident that happened 30 something years ago. I'm talking to you about it. So when you tell it, my son will eventually read my book, he'll know about it, and there's going to be, his children might read a bit, you know, so there's always going to be this, when you bring it out, it's out, you can't go back into the box. So you have to be conscious of that in many respects, and it's good to have good editors. My wife, Serena, edited a lot of the gorier stories out of it before I even got to Penguin, because some of them were, I have some crazy stories, which might make it into a book of short stories and won't be, I mean, that's down the line, but you need to have somebody who'll filter it for you because it can reveal too much. And so part of my problem was just telling too much in certain respects. Yeah. That's why you need ideas. That's why you need people to pull the reins in.
I was going to ask, yeah, have you thought about your son one day picking up the book and learning about his dad?
Yeah, it scares me, to be honest. It does. The great thing, my father-in-law, he's never going to watch this or listen to this. He's Chinese, like my wife is half Chinese. So he was always, when he heard about the book coming out, he's like, oh, I want to read the book, you know. And we never gave him a copy of the book, and he's kind of forgotten about it for some reason. So I'd be more concerned about him reading it, to be honest. it'd be shame, you know, that kind of stuff. You don't talk about the stuff that I talk about, the way I talk about it. I mean, my little fella, he's going to be, like, I imagine I'll have written a few more books by the time he's old enough to read this one. That's definitely the plan. So I think he'll come into it. Hopefully there'll be a volume he can compare. Oh, well, that was an early start. And there's these other excellent books that were well-renowned and well-regarded without being necessarily me spilling my guts about drinking drugs and the like.
Yeah, because like most of the questions we got for you from our listeners was, is there going to be a sequel? But it sounds like you're writing fiction now rather than non-fiction.
The book of short stories that I've been working on for a while. And I'm trying to do a lot of things with it. And because we've been so intense with our little fella and COVID and stuff, it's been put on the back shelf. So over the next year or so, hopefully I'll be getting back to it. And that will have a lot of sort of stories, which might have been, they'll be based on reality, but they won't be real per se. And then I imagine I will do another story about myself in probably 10 years, maybe 15 years. I'll probably write another one. I imagine at that stage, you know, I plan on, you know, ayahuasca journeys and other kind of deeper experiences like that can, you know, carry on the narrative of where I left it without being boring, you know. I don't want to just write another 10 years of what. So it has to be something good. So and I don't necessarily want to have a heavy alcohol and drug addiction in order to be able to tell that story. So I need to really come up with something good. But probably the next couple of books, I imagine, will be a book of short stories, a novel, and then probably something else based on reality. We'll see.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the novel because in Dub Sub Confidential, you make a list of three things that will make you happy. Get closer to your dad, play GA for Dublin, and write a novel. So how's the third of those coming along?
It's going. The ideas are there. The framework is there. I just need really the time and the mental space to be able to actually sit down and nut it out. It's a big one. But I have the ideas and I have the framework. And it's just, again, it's a matter of time and having our business running in such a way that I can spend 2 or 3 hours a day being creative as opposed to working. So that's kind of where we're at with it. Well, it's exciting, you know, and in many respects, in my head, I the three things you talk about, I count Dub Sub as that kind of novel, that kind of story, because it was something in my head that I wanted just to be a well-regarded piece of writing that I did, even though it wasn't necessarily a novel. I'm taking it as one.
Was Stephen Cluxton ever bothered that you wrote about him? Because he is quite private.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't spoken to him since the book came out, and that's not, I mean, I haven't spoken to anyone from the Dublin team unless I've sort of ran into it by accident. And because he's still playing and in that zone, and I've been overseas, and that, you know, just never met. I don't know. You'd have to ask him. Maybe initially, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I sent him a couple of messages as the book is coming out, and, you know, the publishers, they did a bit of ambush marketing. They brought out the day of the All-Ireland final, which was, you know, I wasn't happy about that either, but what are you going to do? You know, I didn't have a choice in many respects. And so I know that might have, I mean, he lived in his own zone, and I know at the time I was really, really concerned about that. But he was fine, I imagine. I'm sure he's fine now. I met his wife at a gig, a Damien Dempsey gig, and we had a good laugh. And, you know, there was no ill will as far as I could tell. I don't know. Big boy, you know, he's had plenty of things written about him, and I know he doesn't like having things written about him, but I don't think I wrote anything too bad. You know, it was all pretty good and honest, and I think he would, if he ever took the time to read it, which I don't know if he would have, maybe he would have, he'd probably appreciate that much at least.
Yeah, because it's one of the best insights we have into why he's so good. So can you tease that out for us? Why is Stephen Cluxton the player that he is?
You know, it's over a decade since I was there, so it's kind of, I imagine he's something similar. And I think he was just extremely dedicated. And, you know, he came from a soccer background. He was a left winger, so he had a left foot on him, so he could cross a ball, he could ping a ball. And he was fast, and he had that just real kind of, not ruthless is too strong a word, but he was just extremely serious about it. You know, he was a serious man who wanted to be a success, and he wanted the Dubs to be a success, and he wanted, I suppose, his life to be successful in that part. You know, he was playing a game he loved, a team he loved, and I think his dedication to it was, like I wrote about in the book, it was unparalleled, you know. I tell that story a lot where I'd get to training and I'd see Stephen Cluxton would be out in the pitch kicking balls, and I'd get there half an hour later, he'd still be out in the kicking balls, I'd get there half an hour later, he'd still be out there. So I used to nearly have to turn up for training at 7 around just after 5 o'clock in order to get out on the pitch at the same time as him. And that was, you know, it was mad for me to kind of try and wrap my head around. But that was his life. It was extreme dedication mixed with extreme talent and an excellent left foot. You know, he had a great ability to strike a ball. You know, a lot of people don't have that. You know, it's quite simple. And Evan Comerford, he's a distant second cousin of mine, actually playing for Tip. He's another beautiful ping from left foot. And it seems certain players have that ability and others don't. And with the change in GAA at the time, we went to kicking tees and teams started to drop off and play a bit more tactically, and he started to, you know, mix with his sort of kickouts to Shane Ryan, and all this sort of stuff happened all in this perfect storm for him, which coupled with him then eventually obviously kicking the ball over in 2011 to win the All-Ireland last kick of the game. And honestly, I could never have been happier for somebody who I daydreamed about a scenario or something like that. You know, imagine kicking it to the hill as a goalkeeper from Dublin against Kerry to lift the first All-Ireland however many years. And I'm just so amazed at how well he managed to keep that inside, because I know him, and he would have been, you know, he would have been bursting with absolute delight about it. And but his persona, when he's in public about it, it's just, it is that serious. And even with, you know, no matter what part of training he was, he'd always be serious. You could have a bit of a laugh at him at certain points, but he'd want to be serious, you know. And I think that's the kind of thing, you know, you hear about it, you read about it in different, I think I read an article, an interview with one of your, on the 42 a few weeks ago, but a guy who plays with Cavatini, his brother thinks underage talent at the moment. Can't remember his name off the top of my head. Captain of Derby County.
Oh, Jason Knight, yeah.
Yeah, they're all apparently quite talented. But he had this seriousness about him and hated to lose and wanted to win. That was just that something different. And I think Cluckow has that. He's got that. He always wanted to win. He hated losing. He hated not being serious. He hated when things were a little bit out of weren't being put. Like if the training session wasn't done to the level that he thought it should have been, he'd be upset about it. Like as goalkeepers, we trained so hard, like professionally, like Gary Matches at the time. He was incredible in what he did with us and helped strip us back. But we put so much effort in, and I think you know when he saw that was maybe not being translated everywhere else in the pitch, yeah, he would have been upset. But that's just a measure of how, you know, how good he is. And look, the last 10 years have been incredible for him, for the team. And I think it's imprinted, his personality is imprinted on them. They're extremely serious. Even though off the pitch you have a bit of crack at them, but they're meticulous. And that all comes from him. They don't relent. He never relented. And I think that personality of his really does infuse the rest of those young lads coming through with this confidence, belief, and a necessity to perform that maybe without him it may not have kind of fused the way it did. Certainly has fused, that's for sure.
That Jason Knight article, actually, I wrote that, so you've doubled your fee and given that a shout out. So thanks very much. Cluckston does seem to be fairly shaped by disappointment of the past and the fact that he was part of the Dublin team that were perceived as, you know, maybe choker is a little bit too harsh a word, but hype merchants and people like the team that couldn't get past Leinster. And I don't know, did you see that interview he gave after the All-Ireland final, the most recent All-Ireland final, where he talked about why he doesn't stay on the pitch after they win the All-Ireland? He generally heads for the dressing room. And he said that, well, he remembers being on the losing side and the winning side, you know, they'd be celebrating. They wouldn't perceive it as gloating, but that's how the loser might interpret it. So he says rather than him being perceived as gloating and reveling in someone else's defeat and disappointment, he gets out of Dodge and, you know, has private moment in the dressing room. So I often wonder how the Dubs maintain this winning machine. Like they don't lose. And I always wondered the motivation for that. And I wonder, is it partly down to the fact that everything really does seem led by Cluckston, and this is a guy who knows what disappointment is like, and this kind of refusal to slide back into that.
Yeah, like, if that makes sense. I didn't hear that, so I'm just reacting to that now. And it does make sense, and it sort of typifies exactly what I just mentioned about his attitude. Like, Cluckow was a very authentic and honest man, and he's, like you said, very serious, and something like that meant that he couldn't face being on the pitch, then he would take himself into the dressing room, and that's what. And he wouldn't change his mind because other people are celebrating. He just go, no, I'm going to do what I have to do. And again, I think that's when you have that kind of attitude, and the young lads would have probably had a bit of a laugh about it, I'm sure. But then they would have gone, well, fucking hang on a second. Here's somebody who knows what it's like to be part of the team I was involved in, and the years before that, when you know there was nothing apart from. I mean, there was glory, there was moments of opportunity that we didn't take, but we obviously didn't win in All-Ireland. I think when they see that, when they see how he is, and it's very few people who could make that go between, I imagine, it, like, infect a whole squad and a management team and with that kind of attitude. And it doesn't, he would never be shouting and roaring about that kind of stuff. He would just do it. And you know, I imagine that the players, and again, I imagine that the young lads would all sort of take that on board and then just sort of go, okay, well, that's the kind of level, you know, and that's the attitude that you've got to kind of bring, whether it's subconscious or not, in order to maintain this. And, you know, you listen to Brian Fenton talking about games almost perfectly. A lot of the lads are very eloquent, but they're very serious, and they're not even in a contrived way, you know. So they whatever fusing of that really seriousness plus that joyful exuberance and the ability to perform, you know, it's been it's been an amazing 7 or 8 years for the lads, and more, probably 10 years at this stage.
Does the funding argument bother you that, you know, usually after Dublin winning All-Ireland, it's accompanied by fraught debate as to how they have been overfunded? Does it bother you at all?
It doesn't necessarily bother me. I think some of the arguments I hear aren't valid. You know, I mean, like, when people say a professional team should always win, and they reckon Dublin are professionals and nobody else is professional, I find that to be sort of disingenuous and very, it's a very loose argument. I mean, because I was there at the time when the funding was involved, even though it was only in the initial years, and there's nobody's getting paid, no one's getting special benefits that aren't being had around the country. The Dublin team don't have a training camp. They don't have a grounds that they go to regularly. They, you know, they're pitch hopping all the time, trying to get somewhere to train. The lads are taking time off, and they're in college, and they're just giving up their lives, like giving them up as much as they can, within reason. And, you know, they're not making money out of it. So I think that, for me, I find that really takes away from any other argument you might have when people start saying that Dublin team are professional. They're not. Like, there's no doubt about it. They have the biggest population. They have excellent structure with great management. They have big backroom team. They've got the best sports science, or at least equal to the other counties, you know. And in my estimation, they should really be winning in All-Ireland every year because of that fact. You know, like, they've got the best setup with regards to that structure, the management structure. They know the standards they have to hit. And it's that kind of, I think, getting over that line in 2011, it starts this kind of roller coaster of, not roller coaster, just this role of confidence and belief. And that kind of keeps growing and growing. And yeah, I don't know. The two things can exist in my head. Dublin can have a funding advantage in many respects. But what else does the GAA do? You know, do you cut off the biggest population centre in the country? No, right? You can't do that. You have to fund them. You have to coach them. You need your game to grow. So you have to look at the structure of the whole country. Like, how can that work? I certainly don't have the smarts to come up with a solution. I imagine an All-Ireland based off league positioning, but, you know, the provincial kind of thing is dead. You know, there's no, it can be run like the provincial inter-county, inter-provincial thing that used to happen, because, you know, Leinster's rubbish, Connacht isn't great. There's a couple of games a year that spark anything. So I think it really has to change to something which better reflects the positioning of the league teams, and therefore you might have better competition there. But yeah, it's a funny one. I mean, the Dublin team are not professional. They have a great structure. They've got good funding. But a lot of other counties do too. You know, I think the main thing is the population base. You know, it's been 20 odd years of having a good structure and players coming through. There has to be a knockout from that. And that's nobody's fault. That's not the Dublin team's fault. That's not the GAA's. I don't think it's the GAA's fault either, because you have to fund. You can't let the soccer hooligans get in, or, you know, the rubber boys, you know, you can't let them take over either. Like, there's a lot of competition. You need to fund these schools and these groups and these coaches to keep interest in the games. So I certainly don't know the solution, but it's not working. You know, the provincial thing should be scrapped, I reckon, or made into a smaller competition, and have the top two divisions play a semi-knockout kind of thing over the course of a couple of months. And that would be a better reflection of the standards, as opposed to this kind of stuff that's at the moment. Yeah. You know, this rates and that. It's, you know, it's jaded. You know, people aren't interested. It's the provincial. Yeah. I think I've said enough about that. Really.
Does it bother you that you didn't win in All-Ireland with that squad under Paul Caffrey?
No, well, I mean, this session and the party at the time would have been, without doubt, the best probably time in my life, you know, even though I had a lot of great times. But that, you know, the feeling when we won Leinster's even at the time was amazing. You know, one of my favourite moments of my life was lifting up the Leinster Cup. Frank Delaney, is it? I can't even remember the name. And, you know, Croke Park had been filled with, the, I don't know how many thousand, 20,000 people. There's flares going, flags going. People were singing Molly Malone. I was one of the last ones, and I got to lift it, you know, and the feeling I got from that was amazing. So to have gone ahead and done it with the All-Ireland, it would have been, you know, how much better? I don't know, but it would have been better, obviously. And I don't have regrets about it. I think I wanted, in my head, it would have given me great closure because I wanted, you know, a couple of years beforehand, I was smoking opium up in the Himalayas, and in my head, I wanted to get back and then write that story of going from there to winning in All-Ireland. And that was kind of my story in my head before it's kind of even happening. And I wanted to call it something like that, Opium in the Himalayas to winning Sam Maguire. But it didn't win Sam Maguire, so yeah, that didn't work out.
It came out in the press subsequently, like I remember reading about the Blue Book at the time when it got leaked to the, I think it was the Irish Indo had it in 2008. And, you know, there's a lot of scoffing at it and a bit of laughing at it. And it did seem kind of absurd. Like, I reread the book in preparation for this, and he'd have you, you know, reciting the General Patton quote. It's a really long quote, by the way. What did you make of all that?
Yeah, it was funny, you know. There were funny times. And, you know, there was obviously a lot of thinking going on behind the scenes. Some of it was a little bit naff, you know. Some of it was a bit naff. And I mean, you go into any gym around the world, you'll have those inspirational quotes and that kind of stuff up there. So that's kind of common to have that kind of stuff. Yeah, the reading, the General Patton thing was funny, you know. It was funny. Like, I remember, I wrote about it in the book, sitting beside Deckman. There's a few of us used to sit beside each other, and you'd kind of shift along depending on what day it was. And, you know, Deckman, Ballyboat, he's tough, hardy boy, you know. And you're kind of sitting there and you're kind of cringing about it. But, you know, some of that, I think, sits in. And then you can retrospectively analyze it and go, well, look, this is all bollocks, you know. And that's kind of the reason why they didn't win. But, you know, if we'd beaten, if we'd gotten to an All-Ireland final and got over the line, which wasn't beyond the realms of possibility, the talent was there. Look, and, you know, tactical changes didn't go our way a couple of times. You know, you'd be rewriting it and going, well, it was these amazing quotes. It embedded this sense of X, Y, and Z into their personalities, you know. And so, yeah, it was funny stuff. I mean, as a poet, kind of, you know, which is what I've always been, as a writer, I've always written poems and writing stuff. I used to love it, you know. I thought it was wacky kind of stuff. Because some of, you know, you'd have snippets of videos as well on Saturday mornings. You'd have different quotes being brought into different things at different times. And I liked it, you know, but probably from a writerly perspective. And like, football teams are very, very skeptical about that kind of stuff, you know, and it's hard to get that across. Sometimes it's a very fine line between losing the dressing room when you start coming out with a lot of that stuff and, you know, imbuing people with a sense of camaraderie. And I think, that got close to the line, I think, a few times, certainly with a few personalities. They would never have read that quote, you know. They would have just been like, fuck, you know. But most people did. Most people bought into it. And that was the whole thing, Billy. So you got to buy in, you know. And most people did. I think everyone did. Like, I don't know. I'm re-remembering stuff there that I'm not 100% sure about, so I better be careful about that.
And this is quite an indulgent question because of the nature of this podcast, but as regards the media, like, were the Dubs, I know you were told not to read the newspapers, but did you read the newspapers? And was it the kind of group that would nail whatever Colin O'Rourke had written to the dressing room wall, or were you motivated by being written off as the hype? The hype was always what was...
The hype. We used to talk about it for sure, but I don't think we ever really were... There was never any of that kind of stuff, you know, Colin O'Rourke. I mean, you'd kind of know what people thought about us. Like, people thought we were full of ourselves and wankers and you know, kind of listened to all this kind of stuff in the media that built us up. I find that kind of... That story always comes from the media in many respects as well. Like, it never comes, like, you never see lads coming into the dressing room cocking the hoop because you know, it doesn't happen. Like, you, they might read it at the time and go, but eventually, like, you don't come into a training session then and start thinking it. And so I find that kind of stuff is, it's spurious at best, and you know, it's stupid at worst. I don't know. I mean, I know Jason Sherrick and the likes, Mossy Quinn used to talk about it at the time. They were very serious. They said, lads, just don't bother reading any of it. So I don't know whether they did. I probably did read the articles, but it was never about me. And I was certainly, you know, maybe I was probably third choice at that stage. So it was kind of, I was kind of just curious and thinking about things. I suppose it mattered really when you're playing a lot. You know, if you're sitting up in the stand, it didn't matter what you kind of thought about yourself. At least maybe that's what I thought. Maybe that's why we didn't win. It's all my fault.
Yeah, like, it's quite an affecting passage of the book, I have to say, when you write about getting the call from Pat Gilroy to say that you're not wanted or in the squad anymore. Like, it was clinically delivered by Pat Gilroy. And then you talked about how badly it affected you because the Dubs had become such an important part of your life at the time. You know, it was the anchor around which you could, you know, build a better life almost. Maybe I'm a bit OTT there, but it was very important to you. And I read that coming away from it and thinking, geez, because it was such a difficult thing to take for you at the time. Was it a little bit too important? Do you ever reflect on that to say that maybe did playing for Dublin or being around the squad, did it become too wrapped up in my identity?
In a word, no, not really, no, but no way. I think anybody who wants to be in that kind of environment, it becomes, you're consumed by it. Otherwise, you probably won't last, or it'll become too much because, yeah. And I mean, maybe my circumstances might have been a little different because I'd been away for so long and I came back and I relished it so much, and my dad had died just before. In the first few months of being involved, and I'd immersed myself into this boyhood fantasy of mine, and my dad, you know, there was so many things for me at the time, and maybe when it was over, I had put obviously too much emphasis into it, because when it's gone and you don't have that kind of other life or other structures. I mean, I was single, I didn't really care about my job, I had no real career, I was. The Dubs had given me kind of everything I'd needed for 3 years, and once that was gone, you know, I just really let go, you know. You could never regret being too in love with being in that team, you know. I mean, it was amazing. It was such a gift for me. Like, and even now, you know, here I am in the northern parts of New Zealand, I can look back and it's still a sweet moment in my life. Not that I do really, no, I don't have time, but if I did want it, it's something, it's an immense thing. And I imagine any young lad or for whatever county or girl or whoever it is from any county in Ireland, they would need to have that, I think, in many respects. You know, you can't sort of rely just on your talent and your ability. You need to have that real passion to be part of something. And again, I think that most in the Dublin team at the moment have that with a better story behind them. And that's, you know, it's part of what makes all the good teams great, having those really, really committed people. I think a lot of lads said it to me, you know, coaches and that said I was, you know, as committed as anybody and more so. If I'd been that way 10 years earlier, it would have been a different story, I reckon, in my life. But such as it is, and I wouldn't have had such a good book with it.
We'll turn for home, John. We have our final two questions we throw at everyone. You've made the rookie error of not wanting a preview of these. We offer a preview to everyone, and then most of the people, you know, fancy themselves to take it on as it's thrown at them and then regret it. So we usually add with work at the end of this, but, like, I mean, you're a writer, so I think we can take life as work on that one. So the most interesting place you've ever been.
I mean, I think one of the most interesting places, and I think I wrote about it in the book, was one that it was a gay bar called Helmet in Taylor Square in Sydney. It was a mind-boggling place. And we went in there, we were all off our heads, and we went in, and you know, it was full-on drag queens everywhere, and lads with leather pants with their arses cut out, and lads, I don't know who, boys, girls, everything, getting pulled around and chains and stuff. like doggies and that kind of stuff. I think that was that was one of the most interesting places ever. But especially when you're off your head, you know, I was out of my mind, and I was just like, it was a fucking mind-boggling place to be.
And the most interesting person that you've ever met?
Apart from my wife, most interesting, Billy Connolly. Billy Connolly, only because I was thinking about him earlier on. I loved him. He was such an interesting fellow. I met him one day and wrote about it in the book in Tulum in Mexico on the off chance and had a chat to him. And I'd always wanted to meet him and do an interview with him because he's been sober and I was sober and blah, blah, blah. And I chatted to him just for 10 minutes. And yeah, that was Billy Connolly on a gay bar in Sydney.
Did you ever get that interview with Billy Connolly?
No, but weirdly, like the way I wrote about it in the book, I kind of did get it, you know. But I contacted his management team again, and I think he'd had another little stroke or whatever it is. He's had, I'm not too sure exactly what happened to him. But he wasn't open to it being interviewed by the Sober Paddy, I'm afraid, at the time. So unfortunately, no.
Is Sober Paddy still running? Can we find your writings there?
No, not really. I mean, I haven't written in a couple of years on it, to be honest. I'm gonna get it back up and running, but it's just one of those things. You need time and to be committed, and I'm and I don't really need to be articulating a lot of excuse I need to talk about. So it's kind of a left beside itself, and I'm always out of place. So yeah, the site is still up. If you want to go and look up some old articles, please by all means do. But it's very old. I mean, the last article was about rape, you know, and it was like when that rugby case was on, and I wrote an article about rape and how not to be a rapist. And weirdly, like, I was in Vietnam, I think, at the time, and I got an email from, I think it was Pat Kenny's talk show, asking me to go on the TV. I think he had a TV talk show. I don't know if he does anymore. I'm sort of out of the loop. But to go on and talk about rape, to be the voice of rape. And I was like, are you fucking serious? Like, this is the level of, like, you can write one article and all of a sudden you're being brought onto national TV to talk about rape, you know, as some kind of voice of authority in some way. I just thought that was absurd, you know. Shout out to Pat Kenny and the team there.
John, we will wrap it there. Thanks so much for your time this morning, and I hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, great stuff. All the best. Thanks very much, Gavin.
Yeah, thanks a lot to John. And thanks a lot, as ever, goes to you for listening to the show and supporting what we do here at The 42. You can get in touch with this show, email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can tweet me, I'm @GQNe93, or you can join the WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that, you'll find those in the episode description of this podcast. That is it for another episode of Behind the Lines, but we will be back again next week with another great guest. But until then, take it easy.